You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 31st of October 2017 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller on today's show.
I am not here in order to demand asylum, political asylum. I'm here in order to act with freedom and safety.
Is former Catalan president Carles Puigdemont establishing a government in exile in Belgium? If not, what is he doing? My guests Carol Walker and Victor Bulmer-Thomas will be discussing this and the day's other top stories, including the sexual harassment scandal of uncertain magnitude which may be about to engulf British politics, the ongoing refusal of the UK's government to reveal what it has learned about the consequences of Brexit, and how do you assess Martin Luther's impact on the last 500 years of human history. That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. So, welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Carol Walker, political analyst and former BBC correspondent, and Victor Bulmer-Thomas, associate fellow in the Americas programme at Chatham House. Welcome both. And we will start in Catalonia and or Belgium, if the latter is indeed to be the seat of the government in exile of Europe's newest nation. Catalonia's former president, Carles Puigdemont, is continuing to insist that he is not seeking asylum in Belgium, nor attempting to evade prosecution in Spain. But he and much of his former cabinet are continuing to not leave Brussels, which may be prompting some anxious piling of furniture against the doors of the local Ecuadorian embassy. Possibly more significantly, Puigdemont has stated that he will respect the result of the snap Catalonian election called by Spain for December 21st. Carol, you were in Barcelona reasonably recently, I believe. Is the sense there that Puigdemont has rather overplayed his hand?
Well, yeah, I just got back last night, and what is extraordinary is that on Monday morning, the big question was whether Puigdemont was going to turn up for work, having made this declaration of independence, having been told by the Spanish authorities that he could be charged with rebellion. And on Monday, we then got this rather cryptic Instagram photograph that he put out saying good morning, showing a famous view from the Catalan Parliament building, leading a lot of his supporters to think, well, he somehow managed to sneak into the building, even though none of the crews waiting outside had seen him. And he's going to defy the Spanish government and carry out his efforts to try to secure full independence for Catalonia. And I think what there is there now is some disappointment, some dismay and real confusion about where this is going to go, because having fled the country, even though some of his ministers are still there, it really does leave that whole independence movement in somewhat a rudderless disarray.
Victor, does it damage his case or his credibility? I mean, in terms of self-preservation, you can understand why he's done what he's done. As Carol mentioned, there were threats or suspicions that he was about to be charged with rebellion, which is no small change. It does carry a roughly 30-year sentence, and you can understand why one would be anxious to avoid that. But it's not really the stuff of dauntless leadership of your people to freedom, is it?
Well, he had to choose between martyrdom and exile, and he chose exile. There are precedents. Juan Perón, for example, in Argentina, left in 1956 and returned in glory in 1973. There's the Ayatollah Khomeini, who...
comparison for which I'm sure Mr. Puigdemont will be grateful.
Who returned from exile in Paris to become the leader of his country. But I think the difference is this, and that is that you have to be the undisputed leader of your movement, as Perón was, and I think to some extent Khomeini was. And Puigdemont is not that, unfortunately. He's very replaceable. So I think he probably made the wrong decision and should have gone for martyrdom.
And the other problem that he has, of course, is that many of those those leaders who've successfully returned from exile have managed to rally international support. The ANC leaders who were in exile at the time that Mandela was in prison actually managed to set up separate missions and embassies in more than 27 countries around the world.
Well, as have many governments in exile, in fairness. The government in exile of Tibet, based in London for many years, to name one.
But the problem that, whereas the ANC managed to gather huge support around an anti-apartheid movement, Puigdemont's calls for independence have pretty much fallen on deaf ears, and all the major powers in Europe have made it clear that they are siding with the Spanish authorities in declaring the independence referendum illegal. And it seems that at the moment, most EU leaders are much more inclined to side with Rajoy, the Spanish leader, and in this, Puigdemont is really struggling to kind of rally the sort of international support that he needs if he's going to make this movement successful.
Victor, has Spain learnt something from its initial response to the referendum, where it sent in, you know, troops with billy clubs and tear gas and was criticised extensively and I think quite rightly for overreacting? Have they decided to instead take the give him enough rope option? They're saying that he is welcome to contest these elections on December 21st, for example.
Well, I think it's interesting that the balance of power shifted dramatically the day after the referendum, but not necessarily in the way that one would have expected. Up to then, the independence movement had been, if you like, one step ahead of the Spanish government all the time. And from the day after the referendum, they were one step behind. And that has made it relatively easier for the Spanish government to chart a more sensible course. They haven't always, as we know, but certainly since the referendum, they look as if they are becoming more statesmanlike in their handling of the situation. And it has helped a lot that virtually no other country or political party has supported independence for Catalonia.
OK, well, let's take a look now at London, where Westminster is bracing itself for a looming scandal, which gives every impression of being one of hefty proportions. As the Harvey Weinstein scandal has prompted and or liberated hundreds of victims of sexual harassment and worse in various professions to tell their stories, a document of uncertain provenance is circulating, which appears to chronicle various improprieties of as many as 40 MPs from the more or less ruling Conservative Party. Some of the allegations contained there, Ron, if true, are certainly career-ending. Others may have more drastic consequences. Carol, I wanted to ask you first. You worked at Westminster for many years and reported on British politics for many years. Is the general culture which is beginning to emerge in recent days and weeks, is it one that's familiar to you?
Well, I have sensed that the culture at Westminster has changed a lot, and I am somewhat surprised by the scale of the allegations that are emerging now. Certainly when I started at Westminster more than 20 years ago, sexist, condescending and pretty unacceptable behaviour was fairly normal. I have sensed a huge shift over the years, at least in part because we now have so many more women in powerful positions right across Westminster. We've got a woman Prime Minister, a woman Home Secretary, a woman leader of the Commons. I think that what has happened is that the culture has changed, but that there are some men who don't seem to have realised this. And I think that there is a particular problem with more junior staff who are employed directly by MPs, and a system that means that when they do feel that there has been an inappropriate behaviour, they have no way of challenging it, because there is this sense that anyone that they might tell about it will probably be a mate of the person who they're accusing, and they are very much discouraged from doing so. The very first day that I walked into the members' lobby of the Houses of Parliament, which was in the dying days of John Major's government, and a senior Conservative MP came up to me and said, "What's a nice girl like you doing in a place like this?" Which was, pretty hackneyed pretty tacky. It wasn't intimidating, but I think it was indicative of the sexist attitudes at the time. I have to say, I think that it is very important that we draw a dividing line between some lewd behaviour, some inappropriate comments, and some of the very serious allegations that there have been, which amount to criminal, potentially criminal offences.
Well, this is the weirdness into which we are about to be catapulted, because there is a distinction there. There is no, of course, clear consensus on exactly where one draws that line. But I think one can say that while the kind of sexist condescension you refer to there is it's just
annoying.
annoying is to say the least of it. Embarrassing, toe curling, ghastly, gauche. You could go on for some time. Quite a lot of what is being spoken about Victor is rather beyond that. It's certainly behaviour, if true, that would get you sacked from most workplaces and may actually get you into worse trouble than that.
Quite possibly. And clearly, the Commons is, or Parliament as a whole, is at fault for not having in place robust procedures. I mean, I, in my time as director of various institutions, academic ones, it wasn't very common, but occasionally these issues of allegations of sexual harassment came up, and we had very clear procedures for dealing with it. We had very clear disciplinary things, and I think what helped is that we had a staff that invariably belonged to one trade union or another. And that, of course, is lacking for these young people in Parliament. They don't have that fallback. And so, as Carol says, they feel very vulnerable. Having said that, we have to be careful about malicious allegations. I mean, I've had to deal with that in my time. And so you have to also have procedures for establishing what is a genuine complaint and one which is a malicious one. And there is a danger that we just assume that all allegations are equally valid, and that is not the case.
Carol, do you have any sense yet of the scale of the bombshell about to detonate beneath Westminster? I mean, we are talking about a weak Prime Minister who doesn't really have a parliamentary majority to call her own. There are 40 MPs on this list. Some of the behaviour on this list, while... again, it's that distinction. Some of it is poor, but does appear to involve consenting adults on both sides. Others of it is not. How bad could this get?
Well, I think comparisons are already being drawn with the expenses scandal, which revealed the scale of the way MPs were using and abusing the parliamentary expenses system and did a huge amount of damage to the whole reputation of Parliament and to many MPs. You do get a sense that the lid is really being blown off something that has been going on under the surface for quite some time. The problem for Theresa May is if she starts suspending the whip or kicking MPs out of her party, her already non-existent parliamentary majority is going to get even smaller. We already know that she's reliant on her partners in the DUP to get through parliamentary votes. We've had allegations, quite serious allegations, against one minister, Mark Garnier, who seemed to get his assistant to go and buy a sex toy and apparently thought this was just a bit of a lark. But I think there is a difference between that and, for example, another incident whereby a well-known journalist, Julia Hartley Brewer, has talked about how the Defence Secretary, Michael Fallon, put his hand on her knee. Now, she says this was 15 years ago. She does not feel she's a victim. He has apologised. She doesn't want to take it any further. And I think that the question really is how much of this is stories and innuendos about people who maybe 15, 20 years ago put their hands where they shouldn't have, and that is certainly something which I have experienced, and how much of it is really serious intimidation, threatening behaviour and even assault against more junior members of staff and colleagues. And I think that we are seeing that it looks as though there may be quite a lot more to come on this. And everyone has been expecting that Brexit could be the thing that derails Theresa May's government. But perhaps it could be this which robs her of the majority that she needs.
Well, OK, we're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Miller, along with Carol Walker and Victor Bulmer-Thomas. And coming up next, the well-oiled machine that is Brexit continues to proceed swiftly and smoothly along its meticulously paved road to the sunlit uplands of prosperity.
Monocle has bureau around the world, in Tokyo, Hong Kong, Singapore, London, Toronto, and New York City. In New York City, our bureau chief is Ed Stocker.
You really can be anyone you want to be in New York. You can dress exactly how you like. You can act exactly how you like. There's that tolerance and acceptance that I think perhaps doesn't exist quite like it does in New York in any other city in the world. There's an energy and excitement to living here, and that's what makes it a great place to work in and to also live.
Hear from Monocle's editors and correspondents on the stories that matter and the places that matter every day on Monocle 24.
You're back with Midori House with me, Andrew Miller. Still with me are Carol Walker and Victor Bulmer-Thomas. Let's stay in the UK, where the government's Department for Exiting the EU has refused a request to release details of studies which have been done into the likely effects of Brexit upon the UK economy. It is known that extensive research has been undertaken into the impact Brexit will make on 58 sectors of the economy, but the government insists that secrecy is essential to the policy-making process, though a few sceptical, if not downright treasonous voices have suggested that the government is more interested in blurring the impression that, one, it has no idea what it's doing, and two, the whole thing is going to be a disaster. Victor, if they don't want us to see what's in these reports into the 58 sectors of the economy, can we assume that the news is not good?
Not necessarily. I mean, I think we've got to be careful here, because government does have to have some ways of communicating within departments that is not open to the public. If everything was open to the public, then all we'd get is very bland memos which really didn't tell us very much. So there have to be ways in which civil servants can write things for the eyes of ministers which are not for immediate public consumption. They will, of course, become available later after the 25-year rule or whatever it is. I think the problem here is not that. I understand the need, if you like, for secrecy about certain documents. The problem is that they're not giving us another narrative which does tell us, perhaps in more general terms, about what the consequences of Brexit might be, for good, for bad, or for whatever. So we are left guessing, and of course we tend to assume the worst and assume that all these communications are very negative, and that may not necessarily be true.
Carol, Victor is of course right that governments, you couldn't govern if absolutely every aspect of government had to be conducted in public. But that said, should they be telling us more than they are telling us, or at least thinking about this not as a question of governmental process, but just of media management? Are they being badly organised in not actually putting some other narrative out there?
Well, I think Victor's absolutely right that there's always this phase in the development of policy where civil servants have to be able to give open advice to ministers without that becoming public, and it's not unusual for government departments to refuse freedom of information requests for that reason. But I think it's also an indication of the fact that the government is actually paralysed by the divisions within the government and within the parliament over this whole Brexit process. If it brought out a report that says it's going to be absolute disaster for the aviation industry if we leave Brexit, and particularly if we have Brexit particularly without the right kind of deal that ensures the right kind of safety arrangements and so on, it will be accused of outrageous scaremongering by the Brexiteers in the party. If it brings out a report that says, listen, there's lots of really positive news of how farmers are going to have a fantastic time under a new British Common Agricultural Policy, that those who do not think that Brexit is a good idea are going to say this is complete nonsense and we'll pull it apart. And those reports and the arguments over them will simply further confuse this already tortuous process of negotiations that's going on with Michel Barnier on behalf of the other EU 27. I think it is interesting that today we hear that the government's actually spent already half £1 billion on preparing for Brexit. So perhaps that's something that we should be grateful for, that they are at least getting on and doing some work. And apparently they've hired another 8,000 civil servants to try to make the process work.
Well, half £1 billion at 350,000 quid a day is, I mean, it's pennies, really. It's absolute steal. Victor, have governments, just thinking generally, going back to what you said, that obviously you can't govern in public all the time, but have governments yet figured out how to govern not in public amid the current media landscape, where there is this ceaseless clamour for information and this limitless vacuum which will fill up with nonsense and supposition unless you feed it?
No, the British government hasn't. It's a major criticism of British politics, the British political system. Other countries do it. I mean, Finland is fantastic. The Scandinavian countries too. But they're not the only ones. Some countries in Latin America are quite good about communicating to their voters, you know, the difficulties ahead and the choices that have to be made, et cetera, et cetera. But I think we've got to understand that our political system comes out of a world, an elitist and secret world. And without a written constitution, it's very difficult to change that. We are struggling, if you like, with the cultural heritage of British politics.
Carol, when you're talking about something like Brexit, which has from the off always been on both sides a conversation at least as emotional as rational, how can you communicate with voters? Because basically anything the government says is going to make... it's going to make just lots of people incredibly angry, isn't it?
Well, that is the difficulty that Theresa May has got. But the point is that at some stage over the next 18 months, she's going to have to come out and say what sort of a Brexit she wants. She has been treading this desperately difficult tightrope of trying to keep both the Brexiteers and the Remainers as they were, those who wanted to stay in the EU, on board. It's a balancing act. She's at the same time trying to pursue these negotiations in Brussels. But the EU leaders are saying, look, how can we get anywhere on any of this if we don't know exactly what you want? She hasn't set out what sort of trade agreement she wants. There is some agreement in terms of the rights of EU citizens and so on, but there is no clear sense from her as to whether she is happy to say, right, that's it, we'll just walk away, we'll go to World Trade Organization rules, or whether she is prepared to sacrifice some elements on things like freedom of movement in order to get a closer trading relationship. We haven't even got to that phase of the negotiations yet. And I think that the difficulty is that because she's trying to keep together a divided party without a majority, and she can't afford to lose anyone off either side, that there is this confusion. People feel that across the country that we had this vote, we still don't know exactly what's going to happen. The negotiations are making painfully slow progress. And in the absence of that clear sense of direction from the top, it's very difficult for anyone to really understand where this Brexit process is taking them.
Just finally and briefly on this, Victor, as Carol points out, half a billion already spent, more than 8,000 more civil servants will need to be hired. But that notwithstanding, this is just a thing that occasionally strikes me. Does the UK still seem weirdly underprepared for Brexit in terms just of infrastructure? There's no sort of, no one's building new customs facilities at Dover or anything, for example?
Yes, of course, that is true. And it goes back to what Carol said about the deep divisions within the Tory party. But I have to say, I have absolutely no sympathy with the Prime Minister about these divisions. She is the leader, for better or for worse. She has, as everyone accepts, the right to put anyone round that cabinet table that she wishes. And if she fails to do so, it really is her responsibility. The fact is that for every cabinet minister who doesn't sign up to her vision of Brexit, if she sacks them, she will find at least three or four people on the backbenches willing to take their place and support that line. The majority of Tory MPs voted to remain. Okay, you can say she's terrified of triggering an election. Well, that it's about leadership. I mean, heavens, she's a follower. She needs to be a leader. If she doesn't understand that, then she shouldn't have been in politics in the first place.
Well, finally tonight, it is, of course, October 31st, which is a night when people put on funny outfits and bang on doors demanding things. And 500 years ago, at least as popular legend has it, a querulous monk called Martin Luther nailed to the door of the Wittenberg Schloss Church a list of 95 demands, which was what people did before Twitter threads were invented. So do we thank Luther, therefore, for inspiring five centuries of philosophical enlightenment and intellectual inquiry, or blame him for inciting half a millennium and counting of sectarian conflict? Well, we've got just slightly less than 4 minutes. I think we can sort of nail down, as it were, Martin Luther's place in history in that time. Carol, I mean, it's a preposterous question, obviously. Can you put someone like Martin Luther really entirely on either the credit or debit side of history?
Well, I think what's interesting is that church leaders here in the UK, both Catholic and Protestant, have made the point that this is about commemorating the life of somebody who had such a huge influence on the course of events, on history, not just in the church, but of course more widely across so many different countries. And that it cannot be just a celebration, given the huge loss of life, the appalling bloodshed which that was triggered by. But it was interesting this morning to hear the leader of the Catholic Church in England, Vincent Nichols, saying that he did not believe that it was Luther's ideas that had caused the division. It was the way that those had fed into the power struggle, and that you then had the Catholic Church wanting to protect its power and influence. You then had the rising power of the Protestant Church, of course the king here in England wanting to use that to further his own power, and that most of the appalling bloodshed that resulted was as a result of the battle for power rather than so much the ideas which lay behind those original proclamations.
I mean, Victor, he's kind of a test case, Luther, or one of many test cases for the great man theory of history, the one that, you know, that question of whether, you know, people make the times or times make people. Was he the catalyst for all that followed, or merely the conduit? I guess I'm asking, would the Reformation or something much like it have happened if he'd stayed in that evening?
Ah, yes, definitely. I think, to me, the important thing about Luther, well, twofold really. One is that he, if you like, encapsulates the problem of what you do with an essentially corrupt organization, which is what the Catholic Church had become at that time, when there is absolutely no way in which the leadership of that institution will be able to carry out the reform because it has become so dependent on the corruption. We have many instances today of institutions that are in a similar situation where they're so corrupt that they have become, if you like, institutionally corrupt. They can't reform themselves. So how do you tackle that? So Luther is interesting because what he discovered is that his message was of some appeal to political leaders at a relatively lower level, who were then able to use this theological message, but very much for political purposes. And the other thing, if I may say, about Luther, which I find fascinating, is that he's not, in my view, a great figure of history, but he spawned hugely important movement. And he reminds me of other movements. You don't have to like it, I certainly don't, but Al-Qaeda began with the obscure sermons of an Egyptian cleric in the 1960s. So we have to remember that out of these tiny acorns, if you like, you can sometimes get very big oak trees, and Luther seems to have played that role.
From little things, big things grow. That does bring us to the end of today's edition of Midori House. Victor Bulmer-Thomas and Carol Walker, thanks both very much for joining us. Today's show was produced by Tom Hall, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Tasha Kleeman. Our studio manager was David Stevens. There's music next at 1900 at Section D with Josh Fennett. I'm back with more on the day's main stories on the Monocle Daily at 2200. Midori House returns at the same time tomorrow, 1800 London time. For now, I'm Andrew Muller. Thanks for listening.